Meeting will come to order. We do have quorum. Representative O'Driscoll, did you get a chance to review the minutes?
Yes, Madam Chair. I moved the minutes from our meeting of yesterday, which was the, make sure I get this right, the 12th of April.
Representative O'Driscoll moves the minutes of Tuesday, April 12th. Any corrections? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. We will go on to House File 984, Representative Hackworth's bill. Representative Murray.
Madam Chair, I would move that House File 984 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register.
Representative Murray moves House File 984 be placed on the general register. Representative Hackworth. Oh, well, actually, first, I think what we'll do is have Mr. Shepherd talk about the provisions in the bill. Obviously, it's a large bill, so he's going to talk a little bit about the provisions that we are to look at in this committee, the jurisdiction that we have. And then if, for Representative Hackworth, if you could, in your presentation, try to limit your stuff as much as possible to those provisions. Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair and members, the pages just distributed a summary that I wrote that is titled on top House File 984 Rulemaking Provisions. And there is a House rule that requires bills delegating rulemaking authority to be referred to this committee. And so I've tried to focus this summary on those rulemaking provisions that caused the bill to be referred here. The first one, Madam Chair, is on the bottom of page 4 of the bill and the top of page 5. This authorizes the DNR to prescribe alternative testing periods and methods for certain aquatic farms, and it provides that these alternatives are not subject to rulemaking, but requires the DNR instead to provide reasonable notice to affected persons of any changes in the testing requirements. The next change is on section 24 at the bottom of page 11. And that section authorizes the DNR by written order that would be published in the state register to establish fees to cover the costs of producing and mailing specified pictorial stamps. And this fee would not be set in law, and it would not have to go through rulemaking under this bill. Section 53 on the top of page 22 authorizes the DNR to make mid-season adjustments to possession or size limits in fisheries in the 1837 ceded territory in compliance with court orders, and this would not be subject to rulemaking. It would be published in the state register. Lines on page 25 at the very top of the page, section 58 authorizes the DNR to prohibit transportation of live fish by people age 16 or younger for home aquarium purposes, and this would be done by written order. Section 60 on the bottom middle of page 25 authorizes the DNR to authorize use of game fish eggs as bait and to prescribe restrictions on their use. This again would be done by written order, not by rulemaking. The next section, page 26, lines 27 to 32, authorizes the DNR to establish fees for health certifications. And provide certifying that fish used as bait originate from waters that are disease-free. This would be done by written order, again published in the state register, and would not be subject to rulemaking. Page 29 in the middle of the page, section 65, requires the DNR to amend certain rules to allow an option for game farm licensees to use approved report and sales receipt formats. And this would be done under the good cause rulemaking exemption that is set forth in current law. Section 66 on the middle and to the bottom of page 25 authorizes the DNR to amend a specified rule to allow a person to take fish by spearing on Cass Lake. This also would be done by the good cause rulemaking exemption. And finally, Madam Chair, section 67 on page 30 authorizes the DNR to amend a specified rule to allow legal bucks to be taken in season A for a 9-day period. This also would be done using the good cause exemption. I gave this summary to Representative Hackbarth earlier. If Mr. Meyer from the DNR needs a copy, I can walk one up there.
Thank you. Looks like you have two amendments to your Are those your amendments, Representative Heckbarth?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I do have the A4 amendment, if I could have someone move that amendment. Get the bill in the shape that I'd like.
Representative
Madam
Murray.
Chair, I would move the A4 amendment so the author can get the bill in shape he would like.
Representative Murray moves the A4 amendment to your amendment.
Would you like me to explain the amendment first, Madam
yep.
Chair? I will. On line 1.2, there's a section in the bill that has to do with feral swine. There seems to be a complication or a problem with the Board of Animal Health, some conflicting statute issues. We're going to take that out of the bill, address that over the interim, and bring something back on that issue probably next year. I hope that's what we can do. So we're going to address that issue next year. 1.3, that has to do with the sandhill crane issue and creating a new license for the sandhill crane hunting, and we're going to take that out of the bill. That causes the bill to go to taxes, and it also causes it to go to Ways and Means. We'd like to move the bill on to the General Register. If we need to address that in the future, we can. We do need to have a license for that, but we can cover it under the small game license. And last year was the first year of hunting sandhill cranes in Minnesota. The 1.4 and the rest of the amendment has to do with the pilot walk-in program that we have for the state of Minnesota, and this has to do with liability that people have when they enroll their land in this program and the liability that they may have for somebody hunting on their property. And it's just a clarification. The DNR had it in their bill the way they wanted it. It was brought to their attention that this might be a better way to do it. I think we've all agreed that this is what we should be doing. Very non-controversial. So I would encourage a yes vote on the A4 amendment.
Mr. Meyer, did you need to comment on the A4 amendment, or is anybody that needs to comment on the A4 amendment? Do you remember? Mr. Meyer.
Madam Chair, this is a DNR technical changes to the bill.
Members, any questions to the amendment? Representative Murray?
Madam Chair, maybe Representative Hackbarth could answer this. Does this walk-on then also address CRP land, things like that, farmland?
Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Murray, yes, this has to do with anything that we're going to enroll the walk-in program. It's CREP land, CRP, anything that we're going to enroll and use as a walk-in program. This liability issue will pertain to that.
Hey, Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, we don't really have competency in this committee to do these amendments or to evaluate them. I just wonder why we're doing this here instead of doing it in the subject matter committee.
Representative Heckbarth.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Winkler. This was brought to our attention after the Environment Committee. It was just some technical changes. We didn't think it would be a problem to do that here. I did talk to the chair about these, and he is aware of these changes and doesn't have a problem with that. And Mr. Meyer can address that, too, if you'd like.
Mr. Meyer?
Madam Chair, members, this is a cleaner way of doing the liability exemption that we had previously to the bill. Rather than create a new subdivision, you'll see on page 29, lines 29.11 to 29.15 of the bill, we're actually changing that language and inserting the same intent into existing language just as a new number 4 on the amendment. It currently deals with recreational liability exemptions. After consulting with some other stakeholders, they were concerned about adding this new piece to the statute. So it was working through some concerns. This is what we came up with.
Okay, Madam Chair, just so the testimony is on the amendment, that there's no controversy and there's nobody who would object, that's fine.
Representative Coleman, do you have a question for the A4 amendment?
Madam Chair, looking over A4 amendment, none of these were controversial sections, with heated debate in the committee. So, as being on that committee, I would not see a major objection to going forward.
Any other discussion to the A4 amendment? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the A4 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. Amendment does prevail. And Representative Hackbarth, would you like the 282 moved as well?
Correct.
Representative Murray?
I would move the A2 amendment, Madam Chair.
Representative Murray moves the 282 amendment to your amendment, Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I do have a technical change to the amendment I'd like to incorporate. On line 1.5, if we could delete the word surrounding and insert the word of, O-F.
O-F?
Incorporated.
Okay.
Thank you.
Did everybody catch that? The Representative Packworth's incorporating on 1.5, deleting the word surrounding and replacing it with the word of.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And this is an issue that was brought to me again after the hearing by Representative Paul Anderson. He's got a problem in his area, and we'd either do it as an amendment on the floor, or we could do it here. I've discussed this issue with Mr. Meyer and the DNR, and he's probably will want to comment on this. But this is a problem on this particular lake, and we'd like to take care of this for Representative Anderson and the people in that community. And it's a huge problem where there's a concentration of these fish, and we feel that there's more fish being taken there than probably should be taken. They all kind of congregate in this area, and people fish there, and they're probably taking too many fish out of that area during spawning time. So I told Representative Anderson I'd bring it here. If we can't get it on the bill here, we'd probably have it as an amendment on the floor. I don't believe it's controversial. I don't think it's controversial. I think maybe the DNR does or some other people do. This was in the Game and Fish Bill that passed off the floor of the House and the Senate and went to the governor last session.
Mr. Meyer, did you want to comment on that? And I forgot, did I ask you to identify yourself for the tape earlier?
Sorry, Madam Chair, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. We have discussed the amendment with Representative Hackbarth. By deleting surrounding and inserting of, it is a more equitable way of closing this water body from people. Our concern was that if you just do surrounding, the word surrounding, it would prohibit a person from fishing from shore, but you could still fish on the lake. If we are doing this to protect the fish populations, we want to make sure that the entire population is protected during this time period. So we'll be working with the author and Representative Anderson as this issue moves forward to make sure that that happens and our concerns are addressed.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Meyer. Is the DNR in favor of closing this lake down for this extra month? It looks like for the fishing. Is that your intent,
Mr. Meyer?
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, I was just made aware of this issue yesterday with Representative Hackbarth. We're still discussing the actual language itself by making sure it applies to the entire area rather than just the shoreline. It makes it more equitable, and right now we're evaluating the language. We're neutral on it at this point in time.
Representative Nelson.
Follow-up then. Representative Hackbarth said this was in last year's bill. Is that accurate? This was in last year's bill. If it was in last year's bill, I guess the question is, if you just was brought to your attention, you should have known about it last year. So that's what I'm saying. You say the DNR is neutral on it. I know last year's bill got mired in some controversy about a provision about that was beneficial to a representative, and I just want to make sure this isn't something that could fall into that same trap.
Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Nelson, this was in Representative Dill's bill. Representative Dill put this bill in not for Representative Anderson last year, even though it's in his district, but this was he has a friend that lives on that lake or near that lake, I believe, and he actually brought it forward for Representative Anderson's constituent. Representative Anderson also supports the issue. Representative Anderson brought it to me just yesterday, but it was actually put in the bill by Representative Dill last year for a friend of, or an acquaintance or a relative or something. I don't remember what it was, but Representative Dill is the one that actually put it in the bill last year.
Representative Winkler, did you have a question? Were you on my list? Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And then for Bob Meyer, so it was just brought to you yesterday. Did you want more time to study it? Or because it sounds like we're doing something in this bill for just one person who lives on a lake. And that's a little risky, I think, for us. And that's why I'm wondering what is the DNR's position on this provision that we're attempting to vote on this amendment?
Mr. Meyer.
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, with the oral amendment to the language, I believe it's much more equitable. Our concern with the language drafted last year would prohibit a person from fishing from the shore, but a person who had a boat or maybe lived on the lake that had a boat, they could still fish in this area. So now I need to go back and make sure that this language works with our staff in providing an equitable protection for everyone on the lake. I understand your concerns. I think we're hopeful we can work through this issue as it progresses. But immediately, I think I believe our concerns by switching that word to surrounding to of help address that equity issue that we have.
Follow-up, Representative Scalzi?
Well, I guess, you know, it would be, I think, more appropriate to have the DNR make a recommendation on this. I'd hate to see the bill have to come back here. But, you know, if we had a recommendation before we got it to the House floor, that would be helpful. I just don't like to do things on the fly that the DNR doesn't have a chance to adequately investigate.
True, although we could also have an amendment to remove it on the House floor if something changed as well. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess that's kind of the thought I had. Representative Hackbarth, would you give us a commitment here that if the DNR comes back to us before this gets taken up on the floor, that if they find a problem with this, that we will have an amendment on the floor to take this out?
Absolutely.
Madam
Chair, Representative Nelson, absolutely. I will do that. This is a process that I'm working with the DNR on, and we're trying to get it right, and we're trying to address the issue and solve the problem, all those kinds of things, take care of these constituent concerns, and I will do that. If we can't work it out, I will have an amendment for myself, by me, to take it out of the bill. Absolutely.
Madam Chair, thank you for that commitment, because this is going to the floor, and that's a concern.
Yep.
Like I said, if it goes, saying we're working on it, then going to the floor, and then it may not get fixed and get passed with it on. So thank
Madam
you for
Chair,
that commitment.
And Representative Nelson, I did make that commitment to Representative Anderson, too. I told him that very same thing, that I will have an amendment to take it out if we can't work out the problem.
Any more discussion to the 282 amendment? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the 282 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendment does prevail. Representative Hackbarth, if you'd like to, I know Representative Shepherd went through some of the areas, but if you'd like to give us your perspective on the areas that affect this committee, this would be a good time.
Madam Chair, I think if Mr. Meyer would like to speak to those issues, if the committee has any questions on the rule making portions of the bill, we can discuss those. But these are really some pretty mundane things that the DNR does. This is just some things that are in this bill all the time. I don't think there's any controversy to the rule provisions whatsoever, but we'd be glad to discuss those. We can go through them one by one if you like, but I leave that up to the committee.
Any questions from committee members? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Section 24, that's about the taking the set fee off and allowing the DNR to set the fee. Is the current fee not covering the cost, and are we going to be looking at an increase in that fee, or is it about right and it's just for future flexibility?
Mr. Meyer?
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, actually the fee is going down. So I feel it's going to be $1.67 after we get this in place. It allows us to more accurately reflect our costs and meet the requirements in Statute Chapter 16 that we cannot overcharge or undercharge, rather than coming back to the legislature every time. And the rest of the provisions in this bill, we take great care in when we're amending our decision-making authority to make sure that Chapter 14 does not apply and we can make these mundane-type decisions, the cost of testing a lake for VHS, things that don't need to go through the full-blown rulemaking process, that's why this language is here, or when a decision is made by a written order that it is published within the state register, so that people do know and can know and track our decisions that are made. So, Madam Chair, you'll be seeing this type of language, at least in the department bills, occasionally that give us these authorities and clearly put in statute how the decisions that the DNR is being charged with are made.
Thank you.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And it just would seem to me, I know this is not a finance committee, but it would seem to me if you've got $2 in there, I don't know why you'd want to lower it to $1.67, but it's not a finance committee, like I say, but to me, that seems like just keep it at $2. Because times are tough, and you're never going to get enough money in the future. But like I say, it's not a finance committee. It's just my own opinion.
Did you want to comment on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Policy, I appreciate that, but we also want to make sure we're charging that the correct price. As I said previously, statute only says that we can't make a profit on these types of things, so we need to charge the true cost of what a charge costs us. But we'll keep that in mind for the future.
Are there any other questions at this time for Mr. Meyer, Representative Hackbarth? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify to the portions of the bill that affect the Government Operations and Elections Committee? No further questions? Seeing no further questions, Representative Murray renews his motion that House File 984 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion does prevail.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you. Next on the docket, we have House File 1088. I'm going to turn the gavel over to Representative O'Driscoll.
Just allow me a second to get reset here and we'll get started. The next bill before the committee is House File 1088, a bill by Representative Drazkowski. And Representative Palm, would you be willing to move that bill this morning for Representative Drazkowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1088 be approved and move to the floor.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski, to your bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, I've also, and thank you, Representative Palm, I've also got an amendment, Mr. Chair.
And is that the A110317 amendment?
It is.
Representative Kwan, would you be willing to move the amendment, the author's amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Oh.
To the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I've got also some oral amendments, two of them, to the amendment itself. The first one deals with, on the amendment, lines 1.10 through 1.12, and I've got some language changes to that, if I could present those, Mr. Chair.
Proceed.
That would be, thank you, Mr. Chair. 1.10, members, we would strike a sum sufficient is appropriated, which would be the first two, four, five words, and then replace them with these words. Unspent general funds that are transferred. I'll repeat it, unspent general funds that are transferred. And that is the extent of the oral amendment for 1.10. On line 1.11, we would strike the entire line, 1.11.
Okay.
And then, Mr. Chair, members, on 1.12, strike the first three words, flood relief under, and insert the word the, T-H-E. And then after second special session chapter 1, so after the numeral 1 on in that line, insert the word are available. Are available. And Mr. Chair, that's the extent of that portion of the oral amendment. The other portion, Mr. Chair,
Representative Drazkowski, the censor was a number of lines that were on there. I'm just going to check and see if Ms. Dyson has that, and then can repeat it back to the committee just to make sure that everybody has it. If you could allow us to do that.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Dyson?
Mr. Chair and members, the oral amendment to the A110317 amendment on line 1.10, delete a sum sufficient is appropriated and insert unspent general funds that are transferred, and then line 1.11, delete the entire line. Line 1.12, delete flood relief under and insert the, and then following chapter 1, comma, insert are available, so that it would read unspent general funds that are transferred to the Commissioner of Natural Resources from the Laws 2010 Second Special Session Chapter 1 are available to be dispersed, etc.
Representative Truskowski, did we catch that correctly?
That is perfect, Mr. Chair.
All right. And to your second amendment, please.
That is, members, I would add a provision to the amendment that on line 3.13 of the bill, the last, I believe, seven words would be stricken on line 3.13. Those words are, and license fees must not be waived.
Ms. Dyson, have you memorialized that change as well?
Mr. Chair, yes. On the bill itself, page 3, line 13, delete, and license fees must not be waived. So the sentence would read, for a nursing home placing beds in or removing them from layaway under this subdivision, property payment rates must not be adjusted.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that is accurate.
Right.
I appreciate it. Mr. Chair and members, that last amendment to the amendment that we just talked about on line 3.13 was brought by the Department of Health. As a matter of fact, members, most of the bill all of the bill are brought by different agencies for adjustments to Chapter 12A, but we'll get into that. The amendment, members, I would like, if we could, Mr. Chair, to hear a little bit from Mayor Al Christensen, who is the mayor of Zumbrough Falls. It speaks to the second portion of the amendment that we had the greatest amount of amendments to the amendment with. Or maybe we need to vote on the amendments to the amendment first, don't we, Mr. Chair?
What we might want to do is work to get the bill in the shape that you want and then hear from your witnesses that.
Okay.
Then we'll be working with everything on the same page here because there was a couple of different changes. So with that, Representative Quam have moved the amendment and the author is looking for oral amendments. Are there questions from members of the committee on the amendment?
Well, yeah, Mr. Chair,
Representative,
I just wonder if we could hear from the agency about the amendment before we
certainly
adopt.
Certainly.
Mr. Chair, you want to hear Representative Winkler, the DNR?
Okay.
Or somebody from an agency. We got the Department of Health, but she probably isn't going to speak to, maybe she can speak to nursing homes, but is there anybody who can speak to your amendment?
Which portion of it, Representative Winkler?
Both. Anything.
Okay. We'll have Mr. Chair Susan Winkleman from the Department of Health to talk about that particular portion.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record, and then begin with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Susan Winkleman. I'm the Assistant Division Director in the Division of Compliance Monitoring in the State Health Department, and we regulate and license nursing homes. The portion of the bill and amendment that I can talk to is Section 6, and the bill language gives or waives timelines that are required in the normal nursing home layaway bed process. And those timelines that exist now require nursing homes to submit a 60-day written notice to the Department of Health before they put beds onto layaway. And then once beds are on layaway, they cannot remove them for 1 year. And so in a crisis scenario, a nursing home obviously would need to put beds onto or off of layaway much quicker, and this is what this bill amendment would do.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the language is a recommendation from the health department?
Well, we offered technical assistance as this was going through, and there were many agencies involved. And we're aware of a situation last fall during the floods last fall, where a nursing home had to evacuate residents. And so based on that situation, we worked with other agencies to come up with language, this language.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair, my follow-up would be this grant to the DNR to retire municipal sewer debt. And that's obviously not for the health department, but I wonder if there's anybody else who can speak to that. It seems like an odd combination of...
Maybe what we'd want to do is bring Representative Droszkowski back and then hear from the mayor of Zumbro Falls to that matter, and that might give us some insight.
Yeah, but and I'd like, before we adopt the amendment, I hope we...
That, I'm fine with that.
Okay.
Representative Droszkowski, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This particular portion of the amendment, members... as you know, the flood happened on the 22nd, 23rd of September of last year in the central and western part of my district and many other members' districts. It was a 25 or 27 county-wide event. Wabasha County was undoubtedly the most severely and acutely hit part of the flood area, if you will. Two of the towns, cities within Wabasha County, both Zumbro Falls and Hammond, received very extensive damage. I believe, and Mayor Christensen can talk about this, but anywhere from 45 to 60% of the houses and or buildings and structures were affected in each of those towns, and each of them also have outstanding sewer and water bonds for infrastructure that they put in place in their towns. I think it was 2007 in Zumbro Falls. So what we have is these a large number of the structures in these towns are going to be bought out through the flood hazard mitigation grant process, which is a federal state flood recovery cost share process. So a significant portion of the people of the buildings to pay those bonds off over time, a significant proportion of them are going to be evaporating from those towns, and when that happens, it would leave a very precarious situation. There is not authority in the flood relief bill for the DNR to use funds for this purpose, and Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler and members, that's why the amendment's coming forward. But if you'd entertain it, Mr. Chair, Mayor Christensen is here to talk a little bit more about Zumbro Falls to give us some context.
Thank you, Representative Droszkowski. Mayor, welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name's Alan Christensen, Mayor of Zumbro Falls. I want to thank the committee for allowing me to speak to you today and to speak to Representative Droszkowski's point. What happened on the 23rd of September was pretty devastating to our community, and we're looking at, as Representative Droszkowski talked about 60% of the structures in the town were underwater at some point during the flood. And as a consequence of that, a significant portion of the town was substantially damaged under FEMA regulations, and has led to a buyout program that looks like currently that we'll lose about 31 customers to our water and sewer system, and looking at roughly about 28.5% of our revenues evaporating once this program is done. And considering that we had put in an extensive new water system in 2007, that portion of it, coupled with the flood draining our reserves, has left us in a pretty tough spot going forward. And considering that, and the main point that I want to talk, I guess, is that we were already charging rather high water and sewer rates because of the project, and we're seeing a difficulty on our residents meeting those obligations, and we would look at roughly probably a 50% rise in their water and sewer bills up to roughly maybe 170 to 180 bucks a month if we were to try to recover it on our own, which is close to twice of what Rural Development talked about as their guideline for their affordability index. So coupled with the flood happening, really has put us in a precarious financial situation, both for our residents and for the city in handling these bonds.
Representative Winkler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe Representative Drozdowski can answer. You can take them. I have a few questions. Number one, is this problem exclusive to Hammond and Zumbro Falls, or are there other communities similarly affected? And number two, is this concept of using DNR funds to pay off municipal debt in this situation something that we should adopt as general language for disaster response? Because we do have statutes in place that deal with general provisions for disaster response. Why DNR funds specifically? And then finally, so those are the first three, I guess.
Representative Drozdowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, the first question is, these are the only two cities within the flood area that I'm aware of. They're certainly the only two cities within Wabasha, Goodhue, or Winona counties, or Olmsted counties as well. So as you think about Southeast, I'm not aware of any other cities. Mr. Lacasmo is here, and I don't know. Mr. Lacasmo, are we aware of any other cities? I don't think so. So it sounds like those are the only two cities within the entire 27-county flood area. The other questions regarding DNR. DNR is the agency that handles the flood hazard mitigation buyouts in coordination with the local communities. And so members, for those that aren't familiar with the disaster relief statutes, what happens is after you write a disaster bill like we did back in October, there is language actually in Chapter 12A, which is the guiding chapter for the administration of the disaster bills as they're developed over time, that says and gives the ability for transferability from one account, for instance, the business assistance account, which is handled by deed, or the housing assistance account, which is handled by Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, etc. If there's unspent monies in those particular areas, they can be transferred to other areas to provide for shortcomings in those areas. And so that is the reason the DNR is identified in the language. And I don't know, Representative Winkler, if I caught your other question.
Representative Winkler?
Well, Mr. Chair, my other question was whether we should be looking at this as an opportunity to create this kind of authority as a general provision in the disaster response statute that we created, but maybe we don't need to bite that off right now.
Representative Winkler, other questions? Representative Scalzi, and then Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question regarding the outstanding debt, and I understand, that you would have high sewer rates. In the buyout program, there's still property available for development after the property is bought out. That's my assumption, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. We're not deleting the opportunity for anyone to use those sewer and water infrastructure on those properties. Is that right?
No, madam. The FEMA program, for the buyout program, says that if they were substantially damaged and they go through the FEMA program, which is a 75 FEMA, 25 match for the state and local, those properties cannot be redeveloped. They're lost. They have to become green space at that point. And that's any of them that go through the full structure of property buyout.
Representative Scalzi? Oh, Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I know this isn't to the amendment, but it's to Section 7 of the bill, as I were talking about the buyout stuff. It seems that this opens it up for not just damaged property or damaged structures. Is this the same part of that same intent as if a property has some structures that are damaged and some structures that are not, to allow them to buy up and get rid of those structure, all the structures on that property, so we have green space so that there's not a building standing there? maybe Mr. Representative Skowski is, because it's opening it up not just to buying out damaged structures, but now any structure on the property.
Representative Skowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, maybe Mr. Lacashmo can talk a little more about that. That's really unrelated. That particular genesis of that provision is unrelated, but there's a particular property in Kellogg, and maybe we could just have Mr. Lacashmo talk about it since he's here.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kent Lacashmo, I'm the Director of Capital Investment for DNR. The deletion of that line, just dealing with substantial projects, was recommended by us because you have instances that after a flood where you have properties that are threatened, like there's a property in Kellogg that sits on a bluff that's eroding that will continue to erode and this house will fall in. So there is a project with federal money to deal with that. So some state money is going towards the acquisition of that property. And there are property, substantially damaged has a specific definition, which is damage that exceeds 50% of the assessed value. So you may have a home that's damaged 40% of its assessed value. So by taking out this substantially damaged, it eliminates any confusion that there might be about whether or not we should buy homes and remove them if they haven't been substantially damaged. The goal of the program would be to vacate the floodplain so it's there for water and it's not conflicting with people's homes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Laxmo.
Other questions to the amendment by members? If not, I will ask Representative Quam if he will move the amendment with the incorporations on the 0317 amendment. On the A11.
I just vote no.
So. Yes, Mr. Chair. I would so move that we approve the amendment.
All right, we've got the amendment moved. Is there any other discussion to the amendment? All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? And then the last item that we have is a oral amendment to the bill itself to get it in the shape that the author is looking at, and that is line 3.13, where we made the deletion of the last five words of that sentence. And we had heard from the Department of Health that is something that they were looking at. Everything after the word adjust, and we'll put the period on that, and adjusted on 3.13. Any questions? If not, Representative Quam, you've moved the bill. Are you okay with the incorporation as well?
Yes, right. Mr. Chair.
All those in favor of the amendment and the bill as presented by the author, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Proceed with the testimony, if you will.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to ask Chris Eide, who is the director of the Office of Emergency Management and Homeland Security, to talk in detail of the bill. I think we've kind of talked around the edges already, but the bill addresses Chapter 12A in statutes, which, as I mentioned, is a guiding statute that, upon a disaster bill being written by the legislature, guides its administration in all of the different areas. And this bill is a culmination of efforts, I think, really coordinated by Ms. Eide and her agency with the other agencies that do work in and out of Chapter 12A dealing with flood relief. I think one of the compelling parts of the bill, members, is Section 3, which deals with the Minnesota Investment Fund. Members, if you'll remember, and I know that I was following quite closely as a legislator back in 2008 after the 2007 flood in southeastern Minnesota, and there were two businesses in Rushford that were loaned about $500,000 apiece that didn't have specific physical damage to the property, and the reason, one of the reasons that they were loaned those dollars is because we didn't have quite as sharp of language, distinguishing language, in 12A, and this actually accomplishes that. And I'd ask Ms. Eide to talk about the rest of the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Chris Eide. I'm the Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. During the preparation of the 2010 second special session, those of us that were working on the disaster relief bill realized that there were needs of the communities identified that weren't adequately addressed in the current Chapter 12A. And it was determined at that time that some of these were not directly applicable to the disaster at the time, and that we would carry a coordinated bill to this session so that we could take care of some of those needs that were identified. The changes really in the sections themselves, section one, which is the Board of Water and Soil Resources, it clarifies the use of disaster funds appropriated to the Board of Water and Soil Resources for the Reinvest in Minnesota program, the RIM program. It authorizes the board to establish a disaster recovery program to fund erosion and sediment control, which we did find in several of the communities during the September flood, and the water quality and the watershed protection projects. Subdivision 3 of that section 1 provides that the disaster grants made by that board may be extended for up to 2 years. A lot of these are because of the flood fight and because of the damage immediately following a disaster. These projects take a long time to complete, which is why the board is asking to extend for 2 years. Section 2, which is the section for the Department of Education, clarifies how disaster enrollment impact aid is currently being calculated by the Department of Education. We feel that change is a technical change. Section 3, as Representative Drazkowski was talking about, restricts the disaster grants for the Minnesota Investment Fund for businesses that were impacted by the disaster for physical damages only. Section 4 for the Minnesota Investment Fund clarifies that by receiving a forgivable loan, the business must remain in the community for a minimum of 5 years from the date of that loan, and then after which the amount of the loan forgiveness follows the schedule that's been provided by the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development for an additional 5 years. Section 5, which is a Minnesota Housing Finance section, is simply a technical amendment that is conforming to their statutes. As you heard, Section 6 authorizes the Commission of Health to waive the 60-day notice required under Minnesota statutes regarding the layaway of nursing home beds. You also heard already that Section 7 deletes the term substantially damaged, which has a definition that is not always in alignment with the goals of the Minnesota Recovers and the Minnesota mitigation programs. Section 8 also authorizes the Department of Natural Resources to use appropriations when we have a disaster relief bill to install and repair flood warning gauges. We did find that this was an issue in the fall floods, and we needed to make sure that those appropriations were available to continue to have a well-defined flood warning gauge system. Section 10 authorizes the Commissioner of Public Safety to use disaster appropriations when we have a disaster relief bill to provide assistance in coordinating the long-term recovery activities related to that disaster. We found over the last few disasters that families and communities that are impacted really deal first with their physical needs and then move into long-term recovery and really need to work with groups to take care of case management, take care of the services and coordinate the services in a community that are already available, but families don't know about them and they just don't have them coordinated on a regional basis. So what this section does is allows us to provide the technical assistance to the local unit or to provide grants to regional consortia or to nonprofit organizations that will take on the responsibility of coordinating that long-term recovery. We have found that without funds to provide for that coordination, families are lost in the middle, and that it is piecemeal and different from region to region of the state. This would make that a coordinated effort. Section 11 deals with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. The Subdivision 2 authorizes the use of the funds from their emergency relief account in the Trunk Highway Fund for the infrastructure repair, maintenance, and operations that are related to the disaster. Subdivision 3 authorizes the use of disaster funds for the demolition and design costs for roads and bridges damaged by the disaster. We also found from the 2007 floods that there was a lot of the projects that we actually had appropriated money for that weren't completed. And the reason they weren't completed is because nobody had the money to demolish and design a new road or bridge. And so the local units of government were left with without being able to complete those projects because they did not have the funds for demolition and design. And then Subdivision 4 requires that the Commissioner of Transportation, in consultation with the Commissioner of Public Safety, clarify the roles and responsibilities for estimating damage. We have been working toward getting joint damage assessment teams so that we can better figure out what state money is needed as opposed to federal highway funds, as opposed to a federal emergency management funds. So this really is just codifying that this coordination will take place between our two agencies. And with that, I am open for questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Ide. Are there any questions? Any other discussions of the bill? Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson and I were just talking about, it's fine, I have no issue with the bill, it's like that clear, but you have this entire section about transportation infrastructure, and I was wondering whether there was a need to send this to transportation. I don't see Representative Beard here, but you know, there's a lot of issues there. I don't personally feel like we need to see it, but I don't know if there's any conversations about that question.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Duszkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hornstein, yes, I think Representative Beard was open to having it in transportation. Actually, didn't anticipate there would be a lot of discussion, but thought that it would make sense to quickly go through their committee to look at those provisions.
Representative Quam, would you care to make that?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to modify my motion to, in place of the floor, to the Transportation Committee.
Very good. Is there any discussion to that? Any further discussion on the bill? All those in favor? I should read it. House File 1088 recommended to pass and be forwarded to Transportation as amended. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Okay, now we'll move on to House File 462, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move that we approve and send on to the floor House File 462.
Okay, Representative Quam moves that House File 462 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the General Register. Is that the motion you're looking for?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, proceed with your bill, Representative Norton.
Thank you, I will. And this is a bill that's had quite a long and pretty good hearing in Health and Human Services. I will kind of give you an overview of the bill, but your Interest, I think, is in Section 5 of the bill, which is the Nurse Licensure Compact Advisory Committee. So I'm going to give you an overview of the bill so you know what the bill is about. I'm pleased to say that Health and Human Services had
Sorry, Representative Martin. I think, if you don't mind, I'll just have Mr. Shepherd talk specifically about the jurisdiction. I think there's more than just Section 5, but
okay.
Mr. Shepherd could just tell us about what we should be looking at for the purposes of our committee. Mr. Shepherd?
Madam Chair and members, in the little memo titled House File 462 that the pages distributed earlier, I highlighted two sections of the bill that caused it to be re-referred here. As Representative Norton indicated, Section 5, and then also a small part of Section 2 on page 8.27 to 8.29 has a provision relating to rulemaking and provides that, in general, the usual rulemaking would not apply to things that are uniform rules developed by compact administrators, but there are various sections of the Administrative Procedure Act that would apply.
Thank you, Mr. Shepherd. Sorry to interrupt again, Representative Norton. Please proceed.
That's perfectly fine. So, again, I will just give you an overview of what we talk about in Health and Human Service. I'm pleased to say while we had a long, and this is not an uncontroversial bill, it did pass on bipartisan fashion, and I was pleased to see that former Chair Huntley supports this as well, which was really a nice addition. This particular bill has been adopted in 24 states. It's a nurse licensing compact. It'll bring Minnesota a step closer to the fast-approaching future in health care. And that future includes the use of technology, telemedicine, a strong medical home model, and an excellent case management. And this particular bill allows not only nurses to do that within the structure of the hospital or facility that they're in, but also beyond the walls of the hospital to wherever the patient may reside. The bill will provide for continuity of care that quality providers want to give to their patients, whether that be in the instance of Minnesota, many snowbirds who leave Minnesota and go to other parts of the country but want to remain in touch with their local provider and so may call back to their local providers in the state of Minnesota, and often nurses are the ones that take those calls and provide that sort of care. But also patients come to the state of Minnesota for a specialty care, and as you'll see from hopefully the handout you've received, this has a strong base of support by many providers who have people fly into the state of Minnesota, receive care, and then go home. This particular bill, the compact, will allow those nurses to provide care for those patients that are served in the state of Minnesota but then go back to their home, and they can have that follow-up care that they need. The compact isn't simply about bringing nurses into our state, although that is a small part of it. The border state agreement has been in existence since 2002, and what that means is that nurses from the state surrounding Minnesota can come into the state already as part of a border state agreement to provide nursing services. But Minnesota nurses do not have that same luxury of going across to the other states because we're not part of the compact license, and that's what they require. So what this bill does will allow nurses in those 24 states to have a license in their state of residence, and I think this is really important for you to understand. This isn't about giving everyone free access to Minnesota to be able to come in here. It's if they live in that other state, they can provide services to one of those other 24 states. You still have to have the license in the state for which you reside. Okay, so just to be clear about that, because I think there's some confusion. It isn't about interfering with unions or bargaining, because the ability for nurses to come in and get relicensed can occur within 48 hours already. As we saw this past summer, fair share rules still exist in the union hospitals, and it won't be affected by the compact in any way, shape, or form. I want to be clear, because this always comes up, and some of you may have had questions. In fact, I've had a question from one of you. All nurses in the country pass the same licensing exam. The NCLEX, all of them do. Where the differential occurs is in continuing to keep your license. Some states, like Minnesota, require continuing education. Some states have more stringent continuing education requirements, and some do not. And so this, for a few of those states who have weaker requirements than Minnesota, would be a bit of a change. Our expectation would be that the hospital that hires these nurses would make certain that they are kept up to speed. Of course, no hospital wants to hire a nurse that is not of high quality. Certainly, I can speak for Mayo Clinic. They're very excited to have this bill pass, and quality of care is top on their list of of things for their nurses to have. So all nurses practicing in Minnesota are required to follow the laws of our state with or without the nursing compact. I have folks from the Board of Nursing here. They don't need to testify unless you want them to, because you might have technical questions. I have asked them to be here, however, because I am not a Board of Nursing member, nor do I know a lot about the rules and regulations, so they can answer the difficult questions. But there is an advisory committee in Section 5. I know a little less about the other provision that was pointed out in Section 2.7 through 3.0. Though I think it was explained well. And we have this advisory committee. The purview of Section 5 is to help roll out the compact and make sure it's done appropriately with excellent advice, and that's what the advisory committee will do. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have, and we certainly can have the Board of Nursing talk to you as well. Up to you.
I'll take some questions now, and I know that there's at least one person that wants to testify in opposition, but I do have a couple names in the list here. Representative Erdahl, did you have a question for Representative Norton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Norton, a little-known fact around here. I was once a member of the Board of Nursing.
Were you?
I was. But my question, there is no Nurse for America program or anything that would fit into this, is there?
No, there is not.
Representative Norton?
No, there's not, Madam Chair.
Did you want to?
She's just here for the technical questions that may arise as part of the bill. If you'd like to hear from her, this is Shirley Brecky from the Board of Nursing. She's happy to share her thoughts and ideas, but she also wants questions. So,
Representative Simon.
Thank you. And either to Representative Norton or the testifier, nursing is obviously different than other professions. I know in the law, if I had a client in Minnesota in a matter that was venued or located here in Minnesota, a lawsuit, let's say, and then that person or company moved elsewhere, I could still give them legal advice on that matter. Mm-hmm. This sounds like it's obviously different, that nursing is considered the state of the person's residence, regardless of where they got their original care. And it's just different from profession to profession. But my question is, are there alternatives here that are, frankly, less controversial? I mean, what practically happens now? So you have a patient in Minnesota, gets their care in Minnesota, comes here to get their care, or maybe they're already here and then they move. What, as a practical matter, day-to-day happens? That person calls the nurse, and then what? What is happening on the ground right now?
Ms. Brecken, if you could identify yourself for the tape before you respond.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Shirley Brecken, and I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Nursing. I think if I understand your question correctly, it is a patient receives care here in Minnesota, which is very common, and then goes back to their home state. They very often will call back, or even the hospital or the clinic facility calls them to, find out how they're doing, whatever. Ms. McLaughlin is with Health Partners and is an employer who is very aware of that kind of a situation and can probably answer it far better than I. But each state has its own requirements in terms of practice, and the premise is that practice occurs where the patient is, not where the nurse is. So that nurse then would have to make a determination, where is the patient when that patient calls, what state are you in, and does that state law require that I be licensed in that state before I can provide the advice? So do nurses do that all the time? Probably not. Should they? Probably. But I think the difficulty is that it causes a barrier for nurses in their practice to practice within the law.
Representative Simon?
Well, okay. So basically what they should be doing is making sure that they're licensed and offering that, whether they do or don't. We don't know. There's no way of knowing that. Does this same thing happen for doctors? Do the same rules apply? And let's say that someone had a physician that they trusted that they visited in Minnesota, then they go to Florida or Arizona or elsewhere. Does the same rule apply to doctors, that they can't speak to the patient because they're not licensed in Arizona or Florida or so forth?
Ms. Brecken?
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, I don't know the laws for medical practice for every state. What I can tell you is that it is true for Minnesota. Because I've checked with the medical board. Some states have passed what's known as a telehealth law that allows that communication to occur for a limited number of hours, you know, to for that communication to take place. That's the best I know about that.
Okay. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much. It's sort of a similar concern that Representative Simon was expressing. Does the Board of Nursing know exactly who is practicing at any given time? So someone from Idaho is coming in. Are you informed? Do you have a sense of who that person is? What kinds of communication is required under this compact for you to know?
Madam Chair, Representative, there is not a requirement in the compact that states that a nurse has to inform a board of nursing that they are practicing within that state. Actually, we don't know who's practicing in our state now. What we do know is who's licensed in the state of Minnesota and authorized to practice nursing in Minnesota. Under the compact, the National Nurse Database, known as NURSES, all of the states who are in the compact are required to submit their licensure and disciplinary data. So that means that an individual, either a board or a patient or an employer, can check that that database, NURSES, and determine whether or not the individual is authorized to practice in Minnesota. They can do that now, and they would do it under that circumstance also. Employers are obligated to assure that the individuals that practice in their facility are licensed and authorized to practice where they do.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Norton.
I see some questioning looks, and I think just to clarify why the Board of Nursing doesn't know everyone that's practicing in the state all the time right now has to do with our border state agreement. Currently, we do allow the states around us, every state around us, North and South Dakota, Wisconsin, Iowa, their nurses can cross over the borders and practice now without a Minnesota license. So that is currently occurring. I actually, one of the things I like about the compact and why I was happy to carry this bill is because I do think it will increase accountability, not necessarily with who's practicing, because that does belong to the employer. The responsibility belongs to the employer to see that they're on a current and valid license through the compact or otherwise. But that when an infraction occurs, the compact tracks that and can share information across borders among the compact states, and so we can follow actually and know more clearly if an infraction has occurred in another state by one of these compact nurse licenses in the 24 states.
Ms. Brecken. Madam Chair, I'll offer a little bit of a clarification. Under the border state recognition law, Representative Norton is correct. The Board of Nursing is required by law to recognize the license of a nurse licensed in all four of our border states as authority to practice in Minnesota. However, those individuals are required in the law to be employed by a Minnesota employer, and they must submit to a state registration. They are registered on a registry to practice under that provision. The compact would not have that same provision and does not now. All 24 states that are in the compact, those nurses are able to practice in those states. As far as not knowing who's practicing in Minnesota, we have nurses who are licensed in Minnesota, live in California, live in Texas that we don't know where they practice. All we do keep track of is that they are licensed to do so.
Representative Hornstein.
Okay, so just to be clear, this is a new area for me, but let's say, so someone is licensed in South Carolina, mm-hmm. But then they come to practice in Minnesota. We don't really know who they are, but are the standards in South Carolina the same as they are here? And I guess, you know, because that's a compact state, so presumably we would be, any nurse in any of these 24 states then can just sort of show up here and practice, as my understanding is, under this compact. Is that correct?
Ms. Brecken.
Madam Chair, Representative, a nurse I would equate it with the driver's license, and while nursing is certainly very different from driving a car, well, sometimes maybe not. You know, there still is the fact that it can be a life and death matter. But the fact is that you have a driver's license in Minnesota. You can drive in every other state in the union. When you are in that state, you have to abide by that state's laws. If the speed limit in Colorado is 75 miles an hour on the interstate and you're licensed in Colorado, you can drive 75 miles an hour on the interstate. But if you come to Minnesota, the law says you drive on the interstate at 70 miles an hour. So it's that consideration. I think that in terms of the basis for licensure that we use today, that is graduation from an approved school of nursing and taking the same national nurse licensure examination, that standard is the basis for licensure in every state in the union.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Norton,
and one last clarification, which I needed to know when I started this process, and is clear: if that nurse from South Carolina moves here and has residence in the state of Minnesota, she'll buy a Minnesota license.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Norton, you mentioned that Minnesota has continuing education requirements for maintaining licensure, and so is the testimony that to initially be licensed, it's the same everywhere, but states differ in how the requirements that they have for maintaining licensure subsequently. So the initial licensing is exactly the same in all states.
The base,
Representative Norton.
Madam Chair, the base is the same, that everyone graduates from an accredited or certified nursing school that's approved and that they have the NCLX, they pass that. That is the same in all the states. The CEUs for continuing, and there may be some other rules, every state has some slightly different rules, and again, the nurses have to follow the rules of the state of Minnesota while they're practicing in Minnesota. For the licensure, we require continuing education for recertification or relicensure. Some states have far more stringent, or not, I wouldn't say far more, but somewhat more stringent requirements than the state of Minnesota. Others have somewhat less and don't have the same CE requirements. Everyone is a little different, and again, the employer can impose as a part of their employment the requirement of CEUs if they felt that was necessary for their nurses, and certainly employers want to have the top quality nurses and are responsible for supervising them while they have them in their building.
Madam Chair, Representative Norton, you want to be careful how far you go with that argument, because that would be a good reason to get rid of all licensing.
I'm not suggesting that at all.
Representative Norton.
So be careful about that argument.
Representative Winkler, and I did also want to point out, too, just to remind folks to stick as close as possible to the, we've been pretty good, but to the jurisdiction we cover.
But Madam Chair, I think this is actually, I think the entire bill is within our jurisdiction. It's an interstate compact. I can't think of what committee would have better jurisdiction over the concept of doing this than ours. So,
well, Representative Winkler, Mr. Shepard went over what our jurisdiction, and I'm just using that as a general guideline just so that we can all kind of keep that in mind. I'm not suggesting I cut off your question or anything. I just wanted to remind everyone.
Okay.
So please go forward with your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we've also, Madam Chair, Ms. Brecken, we've had testimony about this border states law, and I think you said that every nurse practicing in Minnesota either is licensed here or is registered as part of this border state law. And I heard something about Minnesota nurses not being able to go practice in those other states. And you said it's because we are not part of the interstate compact. But why, so is that because they have state laws that say that their nurses can come to Minnesota, but Minnesota nurses can't go there until we're part of the interstate compact? Why is there not reciprocity between those two?
Ms. Brecken.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, in 2003, when the border state, I'll back up a minute and say this compact has been in the works for a very long time. At that time, the Minnesota Nurses Association, as they still do now, opposed the Nurse Licensure Compact, but agreed to a provision in law called the Border State Registry Law. And as I said, it causes the Minnesota Board of Nursing to recognize the license of a nurse from each of our border states. The law also required, at that time, for the Board of Nursing to contact the boards of nursing in those border states and request that they enter into an agreement to allow Minnesota, you know, to be Minnesota licensed to be recognized in their states. All four of those boards of nursing said, no, thank you. We already belong to the Nurse Licensure Compact, and we do not choose to enter into a single compact with just one state. So all four of our border states do belong to the compact and have, Wisconsin has since 2000. And so their nurses can come here because we're compelled to recognize the license. They are not in any way compelled to recognize the license, nor do they choose to.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Norton, are you in this bill, do you repeal that border state law?
Representative Norton.
Madam Chair, that is in Representative McElfatrick's bill, which is traveling in with some other provisions, and if this moves, we certainly will keep that repeal in place. If it does not, we will have to pull it.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, I guess, you know, I think I have the same concern that a lot of people do, which is, and it's not specific to nursing. It's any licensed professional. You want to have, you know, Minnesota tends to have high standards. We like to have high standards. And why would we obligate ourselves to accept whatever standards any other state might put in place? Why not make this a compact that says, we'll join the compact so long as everybody has the same licensing requirements or the same minimum requirements that we have? Why this looks more like a race to the bottom rather than a race to the top, if you will.
I'll have Representative Norton answer them, and I just wanted to remind folks that we do have at least somebody who wants to testify in opposition, and so my intention is to take your question. I have two other member questions, and then we'll move on to anybody who'd like to testify, starting with Ms. Hamilton. And then, but from here on, I'll let, and I'd like to vote on the bill by noon if we can manage. Representative Norton.
That would be great. Let's see. I would completely reject your line of thinking. This is not a race to the bottom. The federal system and the veteran system currently recognizes all states' licenses within the system, and I hardly think we want to say that our veterans and our state hospitals and medical facilities are choosing the poorest licensed people. Employees still have to have the right to interview and hire the best candidates. And I also want to say, I think we're focusing backwards here. This isn't about getting people into the state of Minnesota to practice. What we are doing, and Tom Huntley said it, Representative Huntley said it best, he said this was a very hard decision for him. But medicine is changing. The practice of medicine is changing, and we cannot get stuck in the old way of thinking. We have to move with the times. The Nurse Licensure Compact is one way to broaden the scope of nurses, and it actually benefits Minnesota nurses. I've heard from dozens and dozens of individual nurses who said this will allow them to broaden their practice. They're looking forward to that opportunity because it's about allowing our institutions, and look at the list, there are individual nurses that support this, but also institutions, because they want to take their practice and their abilities and not be restricted by the Minnesota border. They want to be able to serve their facility to patients who have left. So I think we're backward thinking this is only about bringing unlicensed people into the state of Minnesota. It's about allowing Minnesota nurses the opportunity to work outside their borders in agreement with the facility that they work for.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Norton, many parts of the economy are changing. Mm-hmm. Medicine is changing. You're picking just nurses for this purpose.
That's the bill I have today, Madam Chair.
And I guess when you look at events over the last year and you look at the people who support this and those who oppose it, and you look at the limited number of professions involved, it raises certain questions about what the intent is.
Madam
and I don't question the intent of the people who are proposing the bill, but it just seems to me that there's this hard push to let nurses move around. And I really don't understand why this is so important, but it's not important for other medical professionals or other professionals in general. I don't see the State Bar Association running up here every day to allow lawyers to practice everywhere. And the general feeling is it's because each state knows what's best for the people subject to the practice, the professional practice there. So just because you can't answer a telephone call doesn't mean that Minnesota is suddenly going to become a backwater in health care.
Representative Norton.
Well, I'm not going to address all of that because I think those are some very unfair statements, but this is a bill being brought forward to you on behalf of Mayo Clinic and the other many providers and nurses that are in support of it. What happens in the attorneys and other areas, that's up to folks to carry those types of pieces of legislation. We do, in fact, we have moved forward in reciprocity in many other areas in the last few years. I served on the Medical Licensure Committee for 4 years, and I can assure you that we have passed reciprocity legislation in those committees over the past couple of years. So, you know, this is a good bill. I know it's controversial, and it makes me, frankly, kind of sad that 110,000 nurses in the state of Minnesota who this bill could help, MNA, which represents about 20,000 of those, is opposed to it. Frankly, I don't understand why, and they will share that information with you. I think this is good for nurses. It's good for the nursing practice. It's good for hospitals and providers, and I would ask for your support.
Thank you. I will take one more member question before we get Ms. Hamilton to come and testify. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I just wanted to follow up on Representative Simon's question. The answer wasn't given, does this apply to doctors in any way, or does anybody in the room know if it applies to doctors? Because, frankly, if I were out of state and I had a medical situation, I would not call my nurse. I would call my doctor, and I would say, this is what's going on. What can you do for me? What should I do? Is that legal? And somebody in this room must know, because to me, frankly, I don't know why we would limit this if we limit that. I'm not sure what the limits are, but that's important to me. Does it apply to doctors, and does somebody in this room know?
Representative Norton.
Well, I can say this bill is not about what happens to doctors. It's simply about what happens to nurses who do take most of the calls and do the lines at the hospital. Those are questions, some of which came up in the healthcare committee. We did not bring the 10 people that testified at that here, and so I don't have all those the providers here to answer some of the questions about what they do. But I do know that the nurses do take the calls and are on the telelines, and I can't speak for what happens in hospitals with physicians.
Ms. Brecken.
Madam Chair, I would just like to address that telenursing is much more prevalent than telemedicine is per se. And the reason is because a big example, and I know that Ms. McLaughlin from Health Partners could certainly answer the question better than I, but almost all of the major facilities have what they call telephone triage nursing. And that is that when calls come into their facility, it is a nurse who answers the phone. It is a nurse who makes a decision about whether or not it needs to be passed on to someone else, or that there are protocols that they can follow to respond to the caller. So that's a major form of nursing care in the state.
Okay. At this time, I think I would like to take Ms. Hamilton from the Minnesota Nurses to provide her testimony. Welcome to the committee, and if you could just identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Linda Hamilton. I'm a practicing registered nurse with 30 years of nursing experience. I am the president of the Minnesota Nurses Association. MNA is the largest professional union in the Midwest, with over 20,000 registered nurse members statewide. Today, less than half the states have joined the compact, and many states have rejected it outright. Minnesota should as well. MNA has long opposed the Interstate Nurse Licensure Compact because it promotes regulatory changes that could result in real and potential risks for our patients and nurses. Today, you have heard from many healthcare corporations that telehealth is the future of healthcare, and the compact is the only way we can do that. We disagree. We believe there are far less draconian measures for addressing telehealth, including laws like Wisconsin's that allows a Minnesota nurse to follow up with a Wisconsin patient without having to purchase a Wisconsin license. In the past, it took several days to receive verification of a nursing license. But today, with the advent of technology, a nurse can get a license to practice within 24 hours or less. Our concerns with the compact can be summarized as follows. first and foremost patient safety. We do not believe the compact adequately asserts Minnesota's jurisdiction over non-resident nurses. According to Minnesota Board of Nursing's website, their mission is to protect the public's health and safety by providing reasonable assurance that people who practice nursing are competent, ethical practitioners with the necessary knowledge and skills appropriate to their title and role. With all restrictions of the compact imposes, how will the Board of Nursing be able to continue assuring the competency for Minnesota patients? The compact weakens the ability of our Board of Nursing to identify all nurses who are practicing in our state, which may inadvertently protect citizens from inappropriate or unsafe nursing practice. To date, two state's attorneys general issued opinions that the compact violated their state's right to regulate nurses within their borders. Recently, the compact administrators rejected the state of Indiana for trying to amend the compact in order to provide more protection for their citizens. This should raise red flags among policymakers that the compact most definitely interferes with our state's ability to effectively regulate nursing within our borders. Inconsistent state nursing standards. The differing standards in nursing practice acts within the compact states have the effect of lowering Minnesota's nurse practice standards. By de facto, the compact allows the state with the lowest nursing standards to become the standard for every state in the compact. Due process rights. The Nurse Licensure Compact is the first compact to address licensure of individuals. A nurse can experience multiple disciplinary processes at one time. Additionally, the compact requires participating states to share information that may be false because it is shared prior to any final decision or action. This raises confidentiality issues and is inappropriate for information sharing. Finally, employers regulating nursing practice. Nurses take their social contract with patients and our patient advocacy very, very seriously. If the Board of Nursing abdicates their role in regulating nursing and passes this off to employers, it will impede our professional nurses' role as advocates, allowing employers in a market-driven healthcare facility to exercise control over nursing license. This is a mistake and a threat to the public trust. And I would add, do we really want to nationalize our nursing license? This feels to me very much like a national ID would be. This is not somebody driving a car, and we haven't gone there with Minnesota license. We still make people get a Minnesota license and pass our written test. Why would we not want that in Minnesota for our nurses? For these reasons, we urge policymakers to reject the nurse compact licensure. Licensure compact, excuse me. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Erdahl, was it to Ms. Hamilton?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hamilton, just wondering, is there a noticeable drop in quality in the nurses of Wisconsin, Iowa, North, and South Dakota?
Ms. Hamilton.
From Minnesota.
If I understand you, your question, are the nurses from our border states practicing nursing with less skill or competency? Is that what your question is?
Representative Erdahl.
Madam Chair, yes, Ms. Hamilton, considering the fact that they are in the compact.
They clearly are, you know, providing the same care as those in Minnesota. Right now, they are required, however, to look at our laws. They have only one state to look at. There's 24 states, I believe, in the compact. No one nurse can know the laws of each one of those. Right now, a nurse in Wisconsin only needs to know the licensing requirements in Minnesota.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hamilton, so you're saying that our bordering states, because they're in the compact, do not have a noticeable decline in their quality?
Ms. Hamilton.
First of all, I'm probably not the one to be answering that question. I'm not evaluating them individually as a nurse. I imagine there are individual differences between nurses in Minnesota and in Wisconsin.
Okay, I think at this time we do have, I know at least one more person that wants to testify, and then we can bring the witnesses back. Ms. McLaughlin from Health Partners. Just please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Joel McLaughlin, and I'm the Director of Nursing for the Health Partners Medical Group. And Health Partners is an integrated care system with sites located in the Twin Cities, St. Cloud, Duluth, and Western Wisconsin. As healthcare workers, our focus is on what is best and safe for our patients. As the only Level 1 adult and pediatric trauma center hospital in the East Metro, Regents Hospital serves patients from adjacent states, especially many patients from Western Wisconsin. Regions is also a regional burn center receiving patients from North Dakota, South Dakota, and Iowa. As a standard of care, we contact our patients after discharge from the hospital to ensure an understanding of home care instructions, ensure follow-up appointments have been scheduled, and provide support to patients and families. These calls are made to every patient to ensure continuity of care after discharge and to prevent hospital readmissions. Continuity and completeness of care is also important for clinic patients. Patients expect nurses to help them in managing and coordinating their care using telemedicine technology, no matter if they live in Minnesota or are in one of our out-of-state patients. Licensure in multiple states is very expensive. Requiring multiple licensures for all of Health Partners nurses does not support our goal of lowering overall health care costs while providing best care, best experience. So currently, we require all of our RNs working in our clinics to carry at least a Wisconsin license. And again, we have set up through our case management. We have nurses there that carry many licenses across the country to try to make sure that, again, that we are meeting those licensure requirements. The Multi-State Nursing Licensure Compact Bill is an effort to protect the public and minimize unnecessary barriers to access safe and convenient nursing care. To sum up my testimony, I would like you to take away the following compelling reasons to support this bill. This bill will increase access to equitable care. It will improve patient safety. It will reduce health care costs, and it will increase patient satisfaction. The last but not least important reason is that surrounding states are already members of the compact. Health Partners strongly advocates Minnesota's joining the nursing compact for the benefit of our neighbors, our patients, our family members and friends that receive care in Minnesota but may live in a neighboring state. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have questions for either of the last two witnesses, members? We're running a little short on time. Is there anybody else that needs to testify to the bill? Any other member questions? Representative Quam.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank Representative Norton. Until I saw the list, I didn't realize that the four out of five nurses that aren't part of the MNA, you know, what sort of feeling they had. And I see seven nurse organizations listed here, which gives me a little bit more at ease with this. But I was aware of the situation decades ago. My mother-in-law worked in labor and delivery, and she would, in her later career, substitute maternity leave in labor and delivery wards across the state. She was licensed in 16 different states in order to do that. And there are many discussions about impeding Minnesota nurses from going out and working in other areas. I like the border state agreement, but again, it impedes Minnesota nurses from practicing outside the state. And, we're arguing about nurses coming in, and I would say the vast majority that can't come into the state are covered by the border agreement with those states that border us. And so really, this is more of a jobs bill to help those nurses to work outside the state of Minnesota. And it's also a jobs bill and a care bill for all the suppliers. I mean, Gillette, Illini, Sanford, Mayo. I mean, these are multi-state and multinational health care providers and to handcuff them. And, you know, it's if we joined, it would be 50% of the states participating. And I just think that for the good of the nurses that of the state and the good of the health care system and providers, we are a destination for health care, that we just have to seriously consider, and I will be voting for and supporting this bill.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just, as I sit and listen to the discussion on this, I make comments just about the general conduct of some of our members and some of the discussion that I heard. This is a thoughtful bill and a thoughtful motion that Representative Norton's bringing forward with people who are in the care industry, which generally is very emotional, very professional, very noble profession. My wife is one of the nurses, not an MNA member. She's one of the 90,000 people who aren't in this state, but she serves and serves very well. We've got some personal experience with several of the people who support the compact that Representative Norton's bringing forth. And so I react very strongly, although I sat here quietly, when I heard comments like, this is a race to the bottom, and we wonder what the real agenda is, and other scurrilous comments and disparaging remarks that were made about people who might say, you know, we may want to consider the national compact. Maybe there's something there for us. Well, if you don't like the national comment, talk about those things. But to talk about people being engaged in a race to the bottom when we're caring about people's lives, I think once again steps across the line. I've heard that several times in this committee this year. But I'm looking at people like the Mayo Clinic, where Karen and Mike Beard have several $100,000 invested because of what they did for Karen's back. I'm looking at people like Alina Hospital, where I chair the foundation that raises millions of dollars every couple years to take care of charity care that we don't talk about. We don't make a big deal here at the legislature. We just go about taking care of folks. I have some governance relationship with the people at Essentia Healthcare. It's a bunch of nuns out of Duluth that take care of people in eight states in the Midwest, most of them part of this compact. I would dare anyone to look at those nuns and accuse them of being in a race to the bottom, members. So I wish we'd measure our words a little more carefully, try to make our points on the merits of the points without trying to score points by slamming or disparaging or casting aspersions that are completely unnecessary.
Thank you, Representative Beard. Did anybody else have any? Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair. Representative Beard, you might as well have used my name.
No names, Madam Chair.
Well, you were responding to my comments, and in fact, I think I was speaking directly to the bill. What I asked was whether there are standards that are the same everywhere, and they're not. They're different. And this doesn't say that the members of the compact states have to meet Minnesota standards. It says that they have to meet the standard of whatever state they're in. So in that way, it's reducing Minnesota standards from the testimony that I have heard. And to talk about the fact that doesn't in any way say that the nuns at St. Mary's or the doctors at the Mayo Clinic want to have worse nursing care. It just says that maybe the compact isn't the best way to do it. We've also heard a lot of testimony about how this is the future of medicine, but if it's the future of medicine, it seems odd that we're only focusing on one part of the medical profession. So I don't think my comments were anything other than to the merits of the bill, nor were they intended to disparage anybody's point. And and it's also not accurate to describe healthcare providers as people who are just, you know, as though there's no business element to healthcare, which of course there is, and which is not to say it's good or bad. But it's not like the whole thing is done out of charity. So I don't think it's quite fair for you to characterize my comments the way that you did. And I particularly want to say that the question of whether we're reducing standards by adopting this compact is to the merit of the bill.
Representative Norton, I think I'll turn it over to you for some closing words. And if any other compelling questions come up, I can take a quick question. Otherwise, we'll take a vote after Representative Norton gets a chance to wrap up all the discussion today.
Well, I'm just going to thank the committee for their patience. You didn't seem to have any questions about the advisory council, which is what I thought we might be discussing today. But it is a big issue, and I'm not minimizing the controversy. There's concern. But the folks that I'm here representing also our people, as was pointed out, that care deeply about their patients and would do nothing to lower the care level for the patients, whether they live in Minnesota or some other state. Just a reminder, all nurses that practice in the country pass the NCLEX, and also graduate from an accredited school. When they practice in the state of Minnesota, they must follow Minnesota laws. The Board of Nursing is comfortable with this, as am I, and I hope you will be too, and I would ask for your support in this bill.
Any final questions? Seeing none, Representative Quam renews his motion that House File 462 be recommended pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay?
No.
Motion does prevail. Thank you, Representative Norton.
Thank you.
Well, did you start the meeting adjourned?